film listeners. I'm Josh Wall.
And I'm Lexi Cutmore.
Frankly, I love movies.
And frankly, I love true stories.
Welcome to our podcast where we dissect films with fellow film enthusiasts and figure out why we love the medium so much. Today, we are delving back into the series In the Real World, all about our love of films that are based on true stories. And today is very exciting because we're going to be talking about David Lynch's critically lauded 1980 film, The Elephant Man, starring Anthony Hopkins and John Hurt. And I'm so excited because I love this movie. And this is the first time we're getting to talk about David Lynch on this show. So, and Lexi, this is your first introduction to this movie.
It is the first time I watched this.
So, like, did you have any connotation going in, or like, what's going through your mind when you sit down for this movie?
I mean, the only thing I knew about was Joseph Merrick's physical condition. That's mm-hmm. the only thing I knew going into this. So I had an idea of, I guess, what to expect as far as he would look. Like, the reveal wasn't shocking to me,
right?
But I didn't know where David Lynch would take it from a storytelling mm-hmm. perspective.
Yes, for sure. You hear the name David Lynch, even if you're not super familiar with his iconography, you kind of know that he has a distinct surrealist style. And, you know, this is definitely something that's out of the norm for him, at least on the surface, because this is, by a lot of, you know, many accounts, kind of an Academy movie, right? It's a movie that's based on a true story, has a lot of, you know, the style choices that the Academy loves. They got the great stark black and white structure, well-regarded actors transforming themselves into well-known characters. And, you know, this is also based on a play and a lot of writings from Frederick Treves about Joseph Merrick, who is called John Merrick in this film. But Lynch, you know, makes it his own. And I wanted to ask, you know, I love David Lynch very, very much. And I was wondering, do you have a relationship with him at all? Or is this kind of your first intro to him?
This is my first introduction to David Lynch. It's interesting, the style that he chose, because obviously we're in a point in time where noir films are a stylistic choice. You're not limited to that.
Right.
And I know you're a big fan of noir films, mm-hmm. aren't you?
Yes, I am, very much so. And it's interesting, you know, to kind of pair the noir genre with Lynch, because you almost, that's not almost like the first thing that your mind goes to, because he's so, you know, he starts off with Eraserhead and does this incredibly surreal avant-garde like masterpiece that's just incredibly bonkers and has a lot of like industrialization to it. And then does this immediately after, because Mel Brooks saw Eraserhead and produced this movie and loved David Lynch so much. And then, you know, then goes, does Blue Velvet and Dune and Straight Story. And he really found his sweet spot in that genre of like Blue Velvet, Lost Highway, Mulholland Drive all have those like great noir qualities of the dark underbelly of specific locations. I mean, all of those movies, or Lost Highway and Mulholland Drive take place in L.A. Blue Velvet takes place in the Midwest, in Indiana, I believe, somewhere in the Midwest. But he loves focusing on locations that you have at least some reference of, and then going deeper and finding like the darkness there, but also has an approach of humanity to it. Like, this movie stands out because it's a very complete story structure. Mm-hmm. It is a period piece. Most of his films are, you know, in the modern time that they are, you know, set in. Blue Velvet is a bit more of going backwards, but this movie is also like not hard to, it's not a tough nut to crack. You know,
no.
Most of Lynch films have to be kind of, they demand multiple rewatches. They're not always, or they're not meant to be understood to a complete scale. You know, if you watch like Mulholland Drive, you get to the end of that movie and you're like, I don't really know what some of these ideas are. And honestly, neither does David Lynch. And that kind of is what makes those movies beautiful. And I will definitely do an episode of Mulholland Drive at some point. I love that movie. And there's just something about David Lynch that like his originality, his creativity, and his total confidence in what he is pursuing in terms of art that is so fascinating. And you think that with someone like this movie, I wouldn't necessarily call it like a big studio movie, but it may kind of not seem like the director is at the full helm of the story. But you get some really great stuff in there, like the beginning with the low frame rate and the elephant and the woman falling. And that's like a great prologue and some kind of crazy nightmarish sequences that link into the themes of like humanity and compassion. And it's still so good. Like I love this movie so, so much. This was my second time watching it. I watched it for the first time last year. And I just fell immediately in love with it. And I was like, why do people not talk about this movie more? Like, what was your reaction to it?
I don't know if I really had like anything going into it, because I know you said, oh, David Lynch is sort of out of the box as a director. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to read some interviews with him about it, mm-hmm. because though I didn't have time this time around to watch some of his other movies, I still wanted to get a sense of who he is as a director. Uh-huh. And to go back to what you were saying before, you know, he had said in one interview that he sees all of his work as a puzzle to be solved. You know, the viewer is the detective, so you have to make your own experience during this, you mm-hmm. know, cinema epiphany that you're having. Yes. So I was like, all right, I am going into some form of a cinema epiphany. Uh-huh. And I definitely had that.
Yeah.
Not maybe in sort of this, I'm not understanding what I digested kind mm-hmm. of way, like you had said, because this is very straightforward, mm-hmm. but it is kind of a stare you down, this is the ugly reality of humanity kind mm-hmm. of thing mm-hmm. that I personally experienced in it. It was gut-wrenching
yes.
and awful.
Yeah.
But, you know, in a way where if you're a good person, uh-huh. you go, I would never do that to someone. Uh-huh.
And setting it in a time, you know, this film, just to do like some quick specs on it. You know, it's from 1980, all about Joseph Merrick. And this is set in London in, I believe, the late 1800s, like 1880s, I believe. Yeah. And so you get like a good sense of, though you focus primarily on the goings on of the London hospital and this kind of elevation of higher society in that sense. I mean, yes, it's just a hospital, but it's like a very well-renowned hospital. But you then get the duality of it by seeing who's involved in the circus and the freak show and the townies, so to speak, and their, you know, obsession with the Elephant Man, Joseph Merrick. And we'll definitely get into that when we get there. But it's such a great way to introduce that theme of humanity, of showing those two sides of, and there is this obvious debate throughout it of, you know, is Frederick Treves different than, mm-hmm. you know, Mr. Bites, the guy who owns Joseph Merrick in the beginning. Yeah, it's just, it's so successful in that way. And, you know, I think in the hands of any other director, it could have been just a boring, drab, like, checklist of a biopic, which I think sometimes a lot of the films in this genre tend to drift into, where it's just like, here's all the information you need to know. And I don't know if all of the information given to us is true. I mean, I think that just by changing his name from Joseph to John is kind of a telling that like the essence of this story is here, but this is a dramatization.
Right.
So when you're watching this, what do you drift towards immediately? What's the first thing that grabbed you as the story was going on?
I mean, from a visual standpoint, you know how much I also enjoy noir films. Mm-hmm. It reminded me, you know, of Gaslight, which uh-huh. I highly recommend if you haven't seen. Uh-huh. But, you know, so the stylistic aspect of it is something that catches me immediately. Mm-hmm. But I'm a sucker for a story where you have growth within your characters, mm-hmm. you know, people who maybe are frightened yes. by something, you know, and eventually learn to love someone, not as they physically present, mm-hmm. but as a person that they are. So watching that is something that I always love to see, because you like the best in humanity. Who doesn't? That's like the first thing that I go to is, will this man get what he deserves mm-hmm. for who he is.
Absolutely. And it's interesting you keep talking about noir, because obviously, you know, Lynch is a fan of the genre. This movie doesn't fall into that category, but what he does bring in is, you know, themes of identity and, you know, integrating the black and white style, which works for, you know, almost the type of photography that they show throughout the film, and pictures are a big thematic intention in the film. So he is kind of blending the two genres there.
Yes.
While it's not an underbelly crime film about a detective trying to do what's right, and there's this nonsensical storyline to it, it does kind of grapple with this idea of, like, there's Joseph Merrick or John Merrick, the elephant man, and then John Merrick, the person. So there is kind of that duality there that you go along, like, in seeing, you know, what Frederick Treves actually is. You know, he's doing it in the realm of science, so it's different than just showing him off, but he is technically doing the same thing. And I also love the growth that the characters go through. But what really struck me is that, like, this movie has stylistic references to a lot of early cinema films. Like, it's a monster movie, you know, from the 30s, the Universal films. But it's also blending the crowd-pleasing nature of the 80s. Mm-hmm. And this movie is, like, right at the beginning of the 80s. So it's an interesting kind of turn, you know. And I think that in the 70s, this movie would have probably been a lot more depressing.
Yeah.
And it is sad, don't get me wrong. But, like, there is this kind of uplifting nature to it at the end that's heartwarming. And there are moments where you're like, oh, okay, yeah, this is like an 80s story moment. Like when Joseph Merrick, or when Frederick Treves, like, almost punches the one guy who's, like, showing everyone the elephant man. That's like, okay, this is like an 80s moment.
Right.
Like, it doesn't matter that I'm a doctor, I'm gonna stand up to you by almost punching you in the face, you know?
Yeah.
And but that, like, those are two things that, like, shouldn't mix. And David Lynch does it by blending them together because he sees the humanity in both of those genres and in everything. And that's what he leads with. He leads with empathy. He leads with wanting to understand the human being. And that's what you need to do, because Joseph Merrick is such a complicated figure, and this is such an interesting story. You know, Joseph Merrick was, you know, is first exhibited as, like, a freak show because he was, you know, he's deformed on, he has, like, lesions all over his body, he has facial deformities, he has one arm that's, like, an incredible growth, and then, like, his left arm was totally normal, his spine was, like, scoliosis to the nines. And, you know, lived a fairly, you know, painful life. But then once he got, you know, hooked up with Frederick Treves, became a part of London society. Were you familiar with any of his story going into this? Or were you kind of just getting this information from here?
Joseph Merrick?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I've heard about him before, mostly because he's an anomaly as far as, you know, the medical history goes. And that's always fascinated me. So I read about him a long time ago, mostly because they don't know what his deformity was. They
right.
have no uh-huh. idea. And this is, you know, we're talking about modern technology. In 2003, they exhumed his body to try to extract DNA from his bones to figure out what the heck was going on, and still don't have an answer. So I think that's another aspect that is interesting about this film, is, like, you see this horribly deformed person, and there isn't an answer. I mean, there are people who have had Proteus syndrome, you know, which is sort of similar in nature, but does not at all explain what happened to him.
Yeah. I'm the same way. Like, I knew the name, I knew the deformity, but I wasn't so certain on the psychological aspect. And obviously, it's a bit difficult to kind of get to the bottom of certain things like this, because the story is so old and from the 1890s, and, you know, record keeping was obviously quite different.
Yes.
So was science and such. And you see, you know, the certain medical practices throughout this film. Treves is a surgeon, and when he's, like, you know, operating on someone for from, like, a machine accident, because we're in the industrial, you know, industrial age, and it's just, like, so gross. It looks awful. It's just like, oh, we've come so far. Like, we're in such a better place, at least in that sense.
Yes.
So how does this movie, I feel like you can watch this just as a movie too, as opposed to, like, an information piece. It's not, you know, it's not very cynical. It's very, but it's also not flashy in trying to bring a figure to life. I think it's just interested in telling the story, and that there's a piece of humanity to it. Like, do you think that's what makes it stand out, as opposed to kind of leaning into the, again, the 80s style of just being so flashy or a puff piece of being like, this was one of our, like, the point of this movie isn't to be like, Joseph Merrick was a hero.
Right.
And he just should have been honored and he just never was. It's like, that's not what this movie is. And I feel like that could have made it a lot worse.
There are, you know, like things you mentioned before, callbacks to, you know, like the 30s with the monster movies, because that was the time of like the Scream Queens. And we definitely get that like flavor in there because these mm-hmm. women are just like belligerent when they see him. Yeah. It's absurd.
It's a lot of screaming for but, sure.
You know, I mean, I don't think that from a storytelling perspective, anybody was trying to kind of step over themselves or mm-hmm. got lost in the mix, because it is something that is better served just telling the story as it was than being inflammatory and trying to, like, you know, insert him having done something crazy and mm-hmm. inspiring, or, you know, really. The one thing I was worried about the first time watching it was that they would try to insert some form of romance with him, because mm-hmm. that did not exist right. in his life.
Yeah.
And uh-huh. people love a good romance story, but yeah. that's just not what it was here.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm glad that it didn't take that turn.
Yeah, I feel like something like that, like if the character of Mrs. Kendall, played by Anne Bancroft in this movie, if like if there was some more fleshed out romance, it would have been, you know, obviously very, very strange. But like this movie, I think focusing on just the base level of relationships is smart, because again, you know, this character John Merrick doesn't have any relationships at the start of the movie, or at least any positive relationships right. that we know. He basically just finds friends mm-hmm. throughout, you know, this movie, and yeah, having this romantic kind of, like, if she was like, oh, I think he's cute, it'd be like, no, stop, like, just no, that's just gross. Like, it's just not gross to find him cute, but just like that would feel in the wrong spirit yeah. of this movie. And it, again, in the hands of another director, it could have easily gone into that realm, but this movie feels fairly realistic.
Yes.
Like, I don't mean that in terms of like a documentary state, but like I feel like this story, the way that it's told, like, I believe everything that's happening. You know, I don't find moments, like, even though there are moments of, like, when the princess of...
Alexandra.
Yeah, princess of Wales. Yeah, yeah, that's right. When Alexandra comes in and is like, I say we make him a permanent resident. Like, that's kind of like the 180s, like, stand up and cheer moment, which I know did happen by yeah. all accounts. But it still has that kind of feel to it. But everything else, for the most part, happens organically, naturally. It doesn't feel like too storybookish. Like, it feels like, and that, to ground it in that, you know, reality is hard, because, you know, modern audiences, you know, this was made almost 100 years after this story. So it can be really tough to kind of get your audience to connect with somebody like that, especially you got John Hurt covered in all this makeup, and, you know, we'll definitely talk about that. But you know, you're kind of giving yourself a wide, like a very wide margin of error, and they stick the landing. You know, yeah. this movie had 8 Oscar nominations. It was nominated Best Picture, Best Actor for John Hurt, Art Direction, Costume Design, Best Director for David Lynch, Film Editing, Musical Score, and Writing for Screenplay, for Adapted Screenplay. You know, and it was successful in that sense. I mean, and it cost $5 million to make domestically. It made $26 million. This is, you know, a British production, a British and U.S. joint production. And Mel Brooks produced this movie. Like, that's crazy. Like, and this movie, like, I wish it was talked about more. And I think that, you know, what has lived on is the caricature of the Elephant Man. You know, right. the joke of the I am not an animal is much more of a punchline now than it is like a reference to like a piece of, like, you know, heartfelt cinema. And I don't want to make that sound pretentious, but that's kind of where we're at. You know, a modern viewer sitting down probably knows the I'm not an animal, I'm a human being scene. But other than that, they probably don't really know what this movie is.
Yeah, I think, you know, maybe something that could draw people in if for some reason there was like more attention brought to the movie in some way or another would be the treatment of people. That was something I was thinking about a lot during this, is we don't have circuses, at least not in the States, where, you know, you're showing off these grotesque people, not in the way that it was in the 1800s, where it was like, behold,
yeah,
you know, this deformed creature, feast your eyes kind of thing. The treatment of other people in society, though is not completely amazing all the time,
right,
is not this severe.
Mm-hmm.
Like, is that something that maybe crossed your mind?
Not immediately, definitely not the first time. Because, I mean, you kind of get swept up in the scenery, like the circus, like when you're first introduced, you're just like, I mean, fuck the circus. But like at the same time, yeah, it looks really cool, like
right,
with the flashing lights and like how like kind of like a labyrinth it is. And when Hopkins is just kind of walking around and looking like it's so immaculately like designed and it's so well choreographed. And I'm just like, wow, this is like a cool world. Like, let's see where we're going. But no, you're right of like. It does also make me think of the one thing I was thinking of a lot this time around was Nightmare Alley, which is Guillermo del Toro's film, or the remake of the film from the 40s. The age of the grifter, the age of, you know, showing people off for, you know, any level of difference to make a profit and to make a show. And, you know, towards the end when they kidnap him and put him back in the circus, you know, people, you know, he collapses and people aren't interested anymore. And there's a couple of different ways I think you can read that. But yeah, very different way of putting people on display, you know. And now it's much more easy to do that, I feel, because of, you know, the internet and social media. But it's different, you know, like, look at how weird this person is dressed, or look,
yeah,
at, you know, this person's lifestyle. It's very strange, which is obviously a bit more of a surface level than what's going on here. But I agree with you, though. I think that, you know, the treatment of people and, you know, the trying to find the humanity is a good way to kind of get people in, again, as a big picture thought exercise, and setting it in such a different environment that people are used to in films is an interesting exercise that I think just works overall.
I mean, the idea of owning another human being, mm-hmm, made my skin crawl. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. Well, even just like, you know, how much they talk about early, like, he's mine. It's all about business. He's a business venture. It's about making money. This is an attraction rather than, you know, a person. And, you know, again, that's kind of the question of Frederick Treves throughout the film, too, is like, yes, he's doing this out of interest, and you do believe that he's a kind man to start, but he puts him on display at like a conference at first, like, this is something that I found, you know. He's also kind of doing it as a reward, like, look what I found, isn't this like interesting, we should examine him, we're gonna give him like a room and keep him comfortable. But like, and they have that, that's another 80s moment where, you know, Treves is like, is there anything different between me and Mr. Bites, you know, spelling the theme out for the audience. But it's an important question, you know, and I think it's essential that if the movie was just like, oh, he's a good person, you know, that would kind of be very, I think, morally not full.
Yeah, that theme is in your face a little bit, you, uh-huh, know, especially during that conference, because I was hoping that we'd see more questions from people of,
yeah,
why is he this way? You know, like, uh-huh, that's something that I personally, though we have no answer for, wanted to see.
Yeah.
You know, like the curiosity, not just from Treves, but from everybody else who's looking at, mm-hmm, him, instead of going, oh, God, get him out of my face, yeah, you, well, know?
That was one of my biggest questions. Like, what is this conference? Is it like show and tell, like a science fair kind of thing? Like, what other exhibits are people bringing up? And it's like, all right, well, I can't. Who follows Frederick Treves? He's got, yeah, the elephant, man. Like, I'm dissecting a frog. Like, it's not that good. But yeah, I would have like you just get their reactions,
mm-hmm,
you know, and I like the way they film it of just showing the shadow of,
right,
of Merrick behind the, you know, behind the curtain there. But yeah, kind of a bit more of a curiosity factor and a reaction as opposed to just being like, oh, this is a hideous person, but like, it's cool that he found it in the name of science. Like, I don't know, it like, you get a little bit more of that when you get into like the board of directors of the hospital, like,
right,
kind of talking about like, do we want to keep this person here? But maybe they kind of sacrifice that because they don't want too many scenes of, you know, people being like, oh, his face, you know, like, which is what you kind of drift into at some point, like kind of risk. But I want to talk about John Hurt playing a role that I think is almost really against type for him in a lot of ways. I think I'm going to take a wild guess and say that the first thing that you saw him in was the same first thing I saw him in, which was Hellboy.
Correct.
And, you know, in that, in the later part of his career, kind of just assumed this father figure to a lot of characters, was a great mentor because he had such a weathered face and was so trustworthy and clearly was someone who was, you know, intellectual and knew what they were talking about. And you immediately trusted them. You know, he was somebody who you could automatically side with. But he was also so good at, like, being evil. Like, he's so good in V for Vendetta, you know, he's like the perfect, like, big face on, like, a screen, you know, and
he's also Ollivander.
That's right. He's also Ollivander. Like, he was everywhere. He is a legend. And I was so sad when he passed away. But here, it's a real test because he doesn't look like himself. Even if you see his eyes, you can't even tell. Like,
that's all
him.
You have.
It's all you got. And you really can't tell. And, like, his voice is totally warped. And he's just covered in this amazing makeup. And he's doing a very physical performance. Like, this time I noticed when he walks, like, when he's, like, in the house going, like, kind of back and forth. I was like, oh, I didn't notice that choice that he's doing. It's so good. And I think he's astounding in this movie. I think he's incredible. He totally deserved the Oscar nomination. He elevates his performance throughout and does such a good job of starting quiet. And then as he introduces more speaking, but, like, you feel for him automatically, you know, like, you just, like, you totally, I mean, maybe understand it's a bad situation, but you empathize with him immediately or sympathize with him. And you, like, want to see him succeed. You're like, care for this man, please. Like, just come into my home, please. And he's so good at that because, like, he's playing a child in this movie, essentially. Like, that's what I noticed this time around. I was like, this performance is very childlike.
Yes.
in an intentionally good way, because he's learning so much about human behavior and customs to, like, you know, just living in England and, you know, looking at pictures. He's so drawn to just beautiful things like that. And it can get into the realm of, you know, the Oscar performance of someone just with, like, a mental or physical deformity or something like that. And that's, like, capital A acting, you know. But this is something else.
Yeah.
This, I think, is something else entirely because, well, one, because I think it's all physical. You know, it's the physical deformity and that, like, elevation of that performance is just another realm that a lot of actors can't really get into. Then he's buried and he actually has to get across so much emotional connection in very few lines of dialogue.
Right.
Because he says a lot, but he doesn't talk a lot. You know, this character.
Yes.
He has to, because he's so, you know, his mouth is very messed up and there's all of that. And it's amazing that he pulls it off.
Right.
You know, and it's not showy. I believe everything about it. Like, it's such a good performance.
Yeah. I mean, I give credit to anybody who can sit and make up for 5 hours mm-hmm. and then go and, you know, perform for however many hours on end.
Yes.
Clearly he hated it. I read the article about him calling his girlfriend and saying, I think they've finally made me hate acting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I mean, he pulls it off because you have to think, like, he doesn't have facial expression. He can't
yeah.
with all of these prosthetics. So we're relying solely on what he's saying when he's able to say it, you know, and the sound in his voice, you know, when he's speaking, how mm-hmm. is he conveying that, you know, the scenes where he's getting relatively emotional because Treve's wife is mm-hmm. treating him like a person. And you finally get that moment where it's like a female is looking at him and not screaming.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Finally.
Yes, for sure. For sure. And he does a lot with his eyes too, you know, and when his eyes are incredibly wide, like when he's building the cathedral, you know, and like showing someone like what he's looking at and how he has to use his imagination. Or, you know, when he does feel like sad or scared, he like closes his eyes and that and like puts his head down almost and like that. Or like at the theater scene when he's like surprised, it is kind of like these half open eyes. It's wide and then it's like half open. And he's like, thank you. And it's so interesting how he was just able to make every single piece of his performance full. He had to do so much to make a little movement seem like a lot if that makes sense. Like, yeah, so much work had to go into just those movements of his eyes to make it feel like a full on like choice, mm-hmm, you know? And it's, I think that's why a lot of people like love doing this play too. I mean, Bradley Cooper says it was the play that made him want to become an actor, and he performed the role on Broadway a few years back. It's tough.
Yeah.
It's really hard, but it's like, I can't think of anyone else doing it besides him. You know, he was just a really wonderful actor and a legend, and someone who was just such a warm presence throughout movies, who you never said like, John Hurt's in this movie. It was always like, oh, great, John Hurt's in this movie. That's awesome, you know? And yeah, the connection of Ollivander too is, you know, so lovely. So I guess I saw Hellboy and Harry Potter around the same time. So yeah, I guess that would be like really the... But I definitely took note of him as the dad in Hellboy. I was like, oh, yeah, him, you know, I see him. And then pair him with Anthony Hopkins, you know, again, another, you know, master of the screen, but also the London stage, and also playing something very different in a very studious role. Very reserved for him, almost, yeah, in a way. You know, when he like kind of has his outburst at the end, I was like, oh, this is kind of the Hopkins that I know, you know?
Getting some flavor of Anthony, yeah, Hopkins I'm used to.
Yeah.
It took me a second to realize that it was him because I'm so used to seeing Anthony Hopkins go.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So wide-eyed, like, yeah, and mm-hmm, insane. So mm-hmm, to see him in sort of a thoughtful, you know, I mean, he's always played an intelligent role from the movies mm-hmm I've seen him in, but it's always been sort of like an unhinged intelligent mm-hmm role. So yeah, for him to be this like calm, compassionate person mm-hmm was different. It works. It definitely works.
Yeah. And you can see him holding back. Like, you can see almost that like he wants to get out more, which is good. It works really well. Like, there's that scene that I really love when he's, I think when he first is trying to teach him to say his name, and he's like, I'm trying to help you. Like, I can't help you if you don't help me. And he clearly like almost wants to have an outburst, but he doesn't, because he's like, I know that's not going to do anything. You're not doing anything wrong. I'm just frustrated. Mm-hmm. But he like keeps all that in. And the only time he does let his emotion out is when, you know, he almost beats up the one guy. You know, I don't even know what that guy's name is.
Is it Jim?
Jim.
The dishonest night porter.
Yeah, but when he confronts him, because he works in the hospital, and he like goes to like punch him, that's like his moment of like, you know, outburst. You know, and I also don't think he's like slumming it. He like, Hopkins is not asleep at the wheel. You know, he's still very locked in. I think he really likes working with John Hurt, and he's good at showing that compassion. I think because early on, you know, he has that scene when he meets, you know, him, and he has that one tear that rolls down. And I believe that. I'm like, oh my God, like he's like actually struck by what he's seen. And like later when he's like trying to talk to Bites about like getting him to examine him, he's like clearly kind of like trying to gather his words, and he's having a tough time doing that. And it's like, it's so good. And, you know, I love Anthony Hopkins. And I think that this, he's another piece of this puzzle that like, I think the role itself, you could say on like when they were casting it, it could have been so many different people. But he works really well. Like, yeah. I'm like, I think like putting him against type, like both of these actors in kind of against type roles of, again, the studious, you know, professorial and professional attire. I know he's a surgeon, but it's still that kind of feeling, because he feels like a teacher to Merrick in a lot of ways, is not what you expect from Hopkins. Right. And maybe that's just because of us as 20 somethings, you know, the first thing that, you know, I don't know what the first thing I saw Anthony Hopkins in was, but I saw Silence of the Lambs like fairly early on.
Definitely.
So like, that, like, it's hard to kind of take your mind out of older Anthony Hopkins, you know, 90s on Anthony Hopkins, where he's, like you said, like very intelligent, but unhinged a lot of the times. Whereas yeah, this is like, he seems like a guy who's just kind of gone through the motions of being a doctor. You know, he comes in, he's got his patients, and when he's doing that surgery, he's just kind of like, well, these damn machines, this sucks.
Another
like,
day.
This is kind of, yeah, new day, exactly. Like, it's just like another Tuesday for him. And then he gets this, and it's like, okay, this is actually something else.
I think that they, you know, Hopkins and Hurt complement each other nicely, especially the scene where, you know, Frederick Treves is trying to get John Merrick to say his name so uh-huh that he can practice that interview. And then we finally get to the interview. And up to that point, you're like, can Treves understand people, you know, is this person with it from a cognitive standpoint? And I did really enjoy the scene where, you know, it's kind of like, all right, this guy's an idiot. We're going to kick him out.
Yeah.
And then they shut the door and he starts reciting the psalm. Uh-huh. And like that moment, you know, the way that Hopkins kind of helped him lead up to that moment really makes John Hurt stand out
mm-hmm.
in his, you know, his role of like, I'm going to assist this person, and him going, I didn't teach him that.
Yeah.
I did not teach him that.
Uh-huh.
And then we open the door and we see, you know, just him speaking and intelligent, and he has, you know, this thought process, and he is a human, and that's very like warming as a viewer to watch that sort of come to light, because you're like, I don't know up yeah. to that point.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And again, that's great for his character arc of like the one line that stood out to me in that moment that I've forgotten about is when they're after the initial examination and they're watching him get back into the carriage and he's like, do you think you can help him? And he's like, I don't know. The man's an idiot. Then to see that scene in particular where he does the speech, he's like, I didn't teach him that. That is a moment of like, oh shit, yeah, this is something else entirely. And it's so cool to see him, you know, go through that progression, because I think Hopkins at the beginning of this, Frederick Treves, is this guy who he is compassionate. I don't think he isn't at the beginning. I don't think he's doing this for, I think, again, in another 80s director's hands, it could have been like, oh, this is the breakthrough I've been waiting for.
Yeah.
Like, I think he's genuinely interested, but also like, this man needs help. But Treves is also kind of like, I've seen it all. I know what to expect. I know what I'm doing. And this is something new to him. And that scene also when they are teaching, you know, and he is teaching him how to speak and he does the psalm, like that is kind of the first moment where he's out of his shell as a child, because, you know, we see him sleeping in the fetal position a lot. You know, he's incredibly attached to his mother and how beautiful she was. And then that you see him working on his own as a man. He's like, I read the Bible every single day. And
yeah.
It's like, you didn't tell me you could read. And he's just like, it's like, oh yes, this is another level of this person. Like that's how you know, like in these movies and biopics, that is like a perfect scene,
yes.
A scene that works every time, where you have this, like in the first act, the first 20 minutes of like an expectation of a character. And then one scene completely adds another level and changes the rest of the movie. Because from that point on, like even if you know somewhat of the story of this movie, from that point, what they do, like even before then, it feels like it is just an animal in a way. Like this character is an animal. And then when they turn and that, and then it's like, oh no, okay, yeah, this is a person. Like the audience has like completely changed their perception and it carries it through. And now you're just like, let's go. And it's like, it's so well done.
From a script writing perspective, it's really smart the way that they went about doing that, because, you know, I was thinking about the lines that they had where, you know, how has Treves been treating you? You know, what's your relationship with him? What do you think of him? Everyone's been so nice. And, you know, for him to just sit there and clearly be nervous and distraught mm-hmm. because human interaction, you know, is not something that he's used to. You're like convinced at that point, this person has no thought process.
Right. Yeah. And that almost is like a cliche or has become a cliche scene in a lot of ways because of, you know, when, yeah, how is your bronchitis? Mm-hmm. And he doesn't know what to say because he didn't prepare for it, you know, and saying he's very kind. Everyone's been so nice. Yeah. That's it. And it is that, it's been turned into not just interview stuff, but also like performance based, where it's like just reading off the script and, you know, being afraid, like it's a stage fright thing almost. And it's great that they also break that conflict really fast.
Yes.
You know, they could have taken way much, like so much more time to be like, have that guy, the head of the hospital, leave. And then be like, you have to speak for him. And then make that another 15 minutes of the movie. It's like, you got to speak for him or they're going to throw you out. You know, that's another obstacle to overcome. And then that gets us into the second act. But they don't do that. They have to get people on his side fast. They have to get some form of compassion to back him immediately. And then immediately after that scene, we have, you know, the head of the hospital being like, could you imagine how hard of a life he's had? Like, you can't. And automatically you're like, okay, they're going to care for him, which then makes the turn of, you know, all of the London civilians and Jim watching him so much more horrible to watch and like terrifying. Like the scene of them breaking into his room is just like I was not expecting that. What was your reaction to it?
I was genuinely concerned. Mm-hmm. And I know how his death happened, but you know, you think like this could kill this man. Uh-huh. You know, yeah. His body is so fragile in the condition that it's in, and to watch him get tossed around and have alcohol dumped down his mouth. I mean, he has a hard enough time breathing just existing.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, that is a great display of the human condition.
Mm-hmm.
Because you are watching someone who's being called an animal get treated by animals.
Yeah, it is the subversion of the roles in that sense. And it also, like, it could have just been they just watch him through the window.
Mm-hmm.
They could have left it at that and it could have gone on longer or something like that. And I guess to some people, I'm sure that would have been effective. I'm not saying that that isn't effective, but that's just one layer of it. And then they break down the door and forcing the girls to kiss him and lifting him up and showing him the mirror of himself and breaking his cathedral, like, and just like destroying everything.
Stealing the photo.
Yes, stealing the photo. Oh, and, you know, throwing him down on the bed. And it's just like, you can't believe it. Like, it's so, that is where the Lynch stuff, because it's not surreal, but that's a nightmare. Like, yeah. That is the worst nightmare of this person. And I think all of us, it's invasion of home and privacy. It's total, like he is almost like back in captivity in that sense. And then obviously he is literally back in captivity, but he is at the will of others in that scene. They're throwing him up and down like he's an act. And, you know, again, his eyes are closed. He's almost just kind of letting it happen and just hoping that it ends soon. And it's so terrifying to watch. Like, it's, I think it's sad the first time you watch it. Like, it's very sad. And that this time I was watching, I was like, oh fuck, this is way more like disturbing than I remembered it being. Like, it's like legitimately like harrowing, that scene. And it's so necessary though, because in any other hands, it could have been way out of left field. It could have been too much, but it works. It's so perfect. It elevates this movie so well because of how effective it is.
And, you know, you watch someone who was in captivity and you think, why wouldn't he have said something to Treves after this happens? But I mean, you know, he's never had a voice for himself.
Uh-huh.
So then you as a viewer have to go, if that was me and I wasn't conditioned to know when to speak up, because that's something that we're taught as children, I would probably do the same thing where it's like, you just say nothing.
Absolutely. One thing that I was focusing on this watch that I didn't really pick up on the first time is the character arc of the character of Mr. Bites, the guy who owns the Elephant Man in the circus in the beginning, because I think he's going through a great period of change in his life too, that I hadn't really picked up on the first time, because he's not just the guy who introduces us to the Elephant Man.
Mm-hmm.
In that great scene where they lead him through the back and like lit the candles and does the show for Treves, and then that's it, you know. But he kind of goes through them, because like another big theme of the movie is like possession and personal value. He beats John Merrick at one point, and then he kind of disappears from the movie. And then once the word of the Elephant Man gets out and Jim starts to gather, you know, people to go see him, Bites shows back up and is like, wait a minute, now the audience is almost in control of the story. Whereas he's used to being like the showman, the leader right. of like the storyteller in that sense. And now the audience is taking control. And then to see him, you know, kidnap him back into captivity after that moment, because he saw what these people are capable of, and to have him go back into captivity and back in the show, and it's not working for him.
Mm-hmm.
We'll circle back to this because I have a question about the scene where they do the show again. But then that just leads to this total fall from grace where he's like drunk and he puts him in the cage with the monkeys and it just passes out drunk. He's pushing the kid over, played by Dexter Fletcher, who is now a director. That's the real fall from grace.
Yeah.
You know, that is the real like total destruction of an antagonist in that sense. And I was so interested in it. I was like, oh, that is a whole other level of this movie that doesn't need to be more fleshed out than it already is. It's like a pretty basic subplot storyline, but it adds a level, like, he's not just this evil, he's not like the carnival barker in like Pinocchio, you know, he's not like meh, you know, he is like a broken man throughout this, and you know, he has to bend at the will of changing society too. And I wanted to ask, like, in that scene when he puts him back in the carnival and asks him to stand up on the stool and then he falls over, and the guy in the audience is clearly like, fuck this, you know.
Yeah.
Are they, do you think that the audience is upset because the show itself sucks because he's on the ground? Or are they like, this is inhumane, like, this is, you're a bad person for doing this?
So I always looked at it as, at this point, you know, there have been the articles written about, you know, John Merrick, and people in London are clearly aware of him. I don't think the people who were spending time with him genuinely would have gone to a show like that to try and see him. I looked at it as the same people who were going up to his window and breaking into his room are the same people who are going to be there. And I read it as they're upset because the show no longer works. You know, he's incapacitated and people want to be entertained and they're not getting what they paid for.
Right.
How did you look at that?
Well, the first time I was kind of in like the almost like the caricature sense, they're like, boo, this show sucks, you know. And I think I think it's a bit more than that. But I am kind of interested, like, if they are kind of like, this is inhumane, like, because that changes the intention then later. But it probably, you're probably right that, like, but are they doing the show? Is that show in London? I thought he was speaking French at one point, so I thought they were in France, but I could be wrong, because he gets on a ship and has to go back to London.
It seems like even then, I mean, I wasn't around, neither of us were, but even then that word about something like that would have gotten out. I don't know.
But I like, again, that feeling of the social environment is changing. He's not going to change. Bites himself is not going to change.
Yeah.
And, you know, it does feel weird, again, comparing Merrick at points to an animal. Because, you know, I know the movie does that, but, like, that's kind of teaching you that he obviously isn't an animal. But, like, he's also kind of been domesticated. He's been put in an environment. He's been integrated into society. People know him and has, at that point, broken through the mold of people just screaming at him. Like, he's having people over to his room. He's having tea. He's having conversations. He's already been through so much and has been, you know, he was beaten and then he was like drugged and putting him back in. He's clearly just so weathered. But then that leads to the really powerful scene of all the other performers in the freak show letting him out. And they're like, we're going to get you out of here. You know, and they put him on the boat and he's like, hey, we got, you know, good luck. It's all we got. You know, it's so like, ah, yes. That's another thing that people can go to for this movie is that, like, you know, it's about people who are, you know, you can read it as like disenfranchisement and people who are seen as others in society banding together to help one another, and how the majority of society, like, you could probably like expand it out to read it about race. You could read it about, you know, LGBTQ rights or transgender in more modern society. And, you know, again, adding that freak show element of like, oh my God, look at how different this is.
Yeah.
It's like, it's so abnormal and it's just inhumane. And it also almost is, I think, realistic and telling that after they let him out, he's not automatically just welcome back in society. He gets off the boat and that little fucking shithead is like throwing spitballs at him. And then everyone's looking like, oh, it's the Elephant Man, because he, like, you know, knocked over a little kid by accident. You know, then that leads to the amazing, you know, I'm not an animal. I am a human being. I am man, which is just like, you know, it's the iconic line from this movie. But again, that kind of keeps everything grounded. It's not like people are running up to him. It's like, hey, it's John Merrick. He's back. How you doing, man? You know, like dabbing him up and shit. You know, they don't do that. There's still this, you know, feeling of like, okay, he's seen as an other. And, you know, it would take a very long time for everyone to get adjusted to him. And it's so, it really like hits home, you know, it like is so well done. and successful in that way, because it's, that's what makes it realistic, is that it's not too showy. It's not so hammy, you know, even though there are moments of the 80s flair, it grounds itself in a realistic, like, if there was someone like this, and I mean, obviously there was, but like today, if there was someone like this in society, this is probably how it would go, you know, a little bit different because of the, you know, the hyperconnectivity of social media and the internet, sure, but the way that he's treated and like the protection that he has under the hospital, but also the, how adverse like civilians are to him. Like, I think it's just so great. It's such a great story. I love it.
I mean, I think that, you know, you would see a similar display today. You don't really have to like suspend your disbelief in the way that he's treated.
Yeah.
But I also don't know how long that would last in today's world, just because, you know, back then, like, word of someone who may look menacing from the outside but has a very soft, gentle personality on the inside wouldn't have gotten around as efficiently as today, where, like, if, you know, an interview was done with someone like him, which in modern times it definitely would,
right,
you would quickly get hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of shares in a matter of like a very small amount of time, where people would be like, oh, if I saw this person, you know, I wouldn't treat them like that. Uh-huh. And, you know, you can easily say that, and maybe that's not the case, but people would be more aware, and I think slightly more inclined to treat him like a human being instead of just like an angry mob that's like, ah, the ugly man, you know?
I think that story would, we would move on from it pretty quickly, though, as opposed to almost like the opposite of that, which is someone who has this very welcoming and positive, or at least a crowd-pleasing exterior, but then is actually a monster on the inside, which we've seen happen many times over the past, you know, 5 years or so. And because of that, those stories, we, you know, the shock of that, of like, oh, this person that I loved is actually like super shitty, like the Kevin Spacey's of the world, or the recent, like, the Armie Hammers of the world, you know, all of that. Even though there's a lot more of them, like, that hits home a lot more, because you're like, oh, fuck, that's really terrible. That really sucks. Whereas that, yes, it's heartwarming and it makes you, you know, feel good, but I think we'd move on from it fairly quickly.
I think now people are more interested in the people who were able to hide their ugliness, you know, because you say you saw someone like John Merrick at a store. I mean, we have laws now that say that you can't just hit somebody for being ugly. You would go, okay, I've never seen that before, but you would move on pretty quickly.
Guess I'm not getting cereal today.
Just
the next style. I want to talk about some of the technical aspects of the film, because we talked about some of the stylistic choices. And, you know, I think filming this movie in black and white is essential to its greatness, because it looks so amazing. I watched this on the, I got the Criterion Blu-ray for my birthday this year, and it's so just, it's just so beautiful. It's a wonderful restoration. It's a 4K restoration, and obviously made on film. And, you know, you get that great grime of the London setting, and, you know, pairing that with this kind of fear of industrialization that Lynch is famous for in films like this and Eraserhead and Lost Highway. And beautiful wides of the scenery and dolly track. The only time that, like, there's a handheld moment is when, again, when Treves goes to punch out Jim. That's where it kind of turns into, like, an actual kind of combat scene.
Yeah.
And it feels, I don't want to say out of place, but different from the rest of the movie. And it's so, again, perfect. Like, the look of this movie is just, it all, like, nothing is out of place. Like, putting in those low frame rate, like, slow motion sections at the beginning with the elephants and the mother being thrown down, and that, again, getting this old monster feel, and those, that one section where it zooms in on Merrick's face, and then you got, like, the flesh pulsating with the people working in the factory, and that's, like, again, another nightmarish aspect to it. It's showing you, like, this is a world that you don't want to be in, for sure. You're like, yeah, this is gross, and this is, like, hazardous and toxic, but the beating heart of it, or, like, the morals are universal that never went away. And I think that you know, that stylistic choice. Like, if this movie was in color, it would be so completely different. It would be very weird. Because you also, like, so much of this movie takes place at night, you know, and in the back alleyways and, you know, in the darkness, which, again, kind of makes it this feeling of, like, shielding yourself from society and, like, all of the stark contrast in the black and white. Like, it's just such a wonderful movie to look at, you know. And I think that a black and white sometimes today is seen as, like, not a crutch, but something that can turn people away from films. Like, ah, it's in black and white. But it's, like, stuff you can do in black and white is really hard, like, yeah, to actually, like, look like it's meaningful and that it works for the story that you're telling. And I know there's, like, Blu-ray covers out there, DVD covers of this movie that are in color, and I'm just like, no, yeah, stop. Like, I, that's just not good. Like, this has to be, like, just void of color so that you can see the character. You know, like, were you shocked by, or, like did the visuals strike you?
I mean, you know, like, when you're doing any kind of filmmaking in grayscale, your lighting is much more dramatic, just inherently. Mm-hmm. So I think that works to the benefit. You know, the first time you kind of see John Merrick, but not totally, because it's candlelit.
Yeah.
Like, you get harsh shadows on his face where you're able to cover up, you know, parts of it without physically covering him up. And that's only something that you can truly achieve in black and white, because it just looks completely different in color.
Right. Yeah. If you, because you also get, like, seeing what his actual skin tone would probably also kind of mess things up. Like, it looks great that he's super pale and gray. Like, when he's, like, when he's first in the hospital, when they give him, like, the room in the isolation ward, he almost, like, blends in with the walls in terms of the color. Again, blending with the old style, like, movie making techniques, like that scene when they first meet him and they turn on the candles and they light those, like, the lanterns. It's so great because it may be something that only I notice. I don't know if you notice this, but, and it's not at all a fault, but you can totally tell that when they turn the lantern on and, like, crank it up, mm-hmm, that it's just, like, a spotlight on Hopkins, like, from clearly, like, off stage, and then they are off screen, and then they do it for Mr. Bites on the other side.
Yeah.
I'm like, that's the filmmaking technique that I love. Like, they clearly worked around it to make it work, especially as someone who's filmed in black and white before and worked in low light settings. That's fucking awesome. And I love it. And it just makes it feel so much more like that. There's so much effort put into that. And it feels so lived in. Like, everything is so tangible. You can feel it. You can, like, touch it. And it's just, it's a wonderfully technical movie.
What's interesting about it is that it's still in a play format, which I've noticed, because sometimes I think in movies that can take you out of it a little bit, I wasn't bothered by the fact that every scene transition was a dip to black, you know, and then fade in kind of thing. Uh-huh. I think it works, which is another reason why if you put the movie in color, I do not think that would translate properly.
Agreed. But that's also the, like, almost 30s B movie love of it. So many dips to black, cross fades, you know, scenes that feel like they could have gone on a little bit longer, but just kind of end, like that scene when after he does the psalm speech and Treves goes to talk to the head of the hospital and he's just like, we don't know what his life has been like. And then it's just like over. And it's like, I feel like there were like four more lines of dialogue there, but I'm not mad about it.
Yeah.
Like, it's like it works, you know, but it's just like, all right, scene's done. On to the next one, you know.
Sometimes I think you're better off leaving your audience wanting more than sitting there and going, oh my God, is the scene over yet?
Oh, no, totally. I think it was a perfect choice. And at points like when, like, the theater stuff at the end feels very like Hitchcockian, like the man who knew too much. And when he's like watching the show and it's, you know, showing flashes of like what he's seeing, like the birds coming down and then the man in the cage and how that's affecting him. It's very like George Millier, like A Trip to the Moon. And especially the end with the face in the clouds and the stars. It's so like fundamental, mm-hmm, to cinema. Like, I think this is Lynch's most fundamental movie.
Yeah.
And I mean that not only just because of some of the earliest references, but that like this is a movie that proves that he knows the basics of storytelling. He's not just a guy who shows you something weird for the sake of weird. everything in his movies has an intention. And it may just be that I thought this looked cool. Because again, he's been very candid about like, these are not movies, like my movies are not meant to be totally put together as a full puzzle or like as a full one thing. You know, you have to put yourself in as the experience, as the viewer, as you were saying, and you know what you feel and you know what you take away from that and what you know is valid. And I think that that's beautiful because it's so self-aware. And he's so seeped in pop culture nowadays. Like, I think a lot of people know David Lynch now because he's made the rounds on Twitter because of his weather reports. If you ever watched a David Lynch weather report, it's just, it's so wonderful. When he tells me that it's, if I can believe it, it's a Friday once again, it makes my heart feel so full. And, I just admire his honesty in that, but I think this movie takes so much confidence. You need a lot of confidence to make this work because he's saying like, look, I'm not just a guy who's going to be weird for you. Like, I know what my strengths are. He is leading this movie, with nightmares. There are some sequences in this that are just like, oh, Jesus Christ.
Right.
But it's all about the heart. And Lynch is a guy who has such a huge heart. And everyone, by like all accounts, loves working with him because he's so empathetic towards actors and really gives them the space to create. And I think that this is a very important piece of the Lynch puzzle. It's one of my favorites of his. Mulholland Drive will probably always be my favorite, but this is like a really good close second because of how different it is. Like, it's also different from like Twin Peaks, which I'm surprised I haven't even said in this episode at this point, because Twin Peaks starts as a show for the smaller screen. And then does Fire Walk With Me. But like, that show is full of nightmare imagery and also full of nonsensical plot lines and questions left unanswered, because of outside factors.
Mm-hmm.
But everything that's in this movie, you can figure out.
I think the only time you get maybe like a hint, a smidge of the David Lynch experience is in the play. When mm-hmm. they're kind of like transitioning between scenes and you're like, all right, I know that this is just what they're witnessing, but also what am I witnessing?
Totally forgot about that sequence you were talking about when I was watching it this time, because I thought it was just like he was watching the theater and enjoying it. But he's having like this almost PTSD reaction to the birds flying down, and he clearly like zones in on the guy in the cage, but he's having a good time and he loves that. People recognize him or like that they give him the recognition that he deserves. And it's very lovely, but you can tell that there's clearly still some pain there and that's not going to go away, and that's heartbreaking. But I love the ending of this movie. I love the way it ends. I love, that we see him alone putting, the pillows down so he can lay down like a person, just like the picture. And he's surrounded by all of the beauty in his life. And then the picture of his, mother's face in the sky saying love will never die. It's like, again, in another realm, it could be so hokey and it could be just kind of roll your eyes, groan, like, I get it. Okay. Yes. Whatever. But it really, I think sticks to the landing because of how the movie takes its time. I think it's a consistently paced movie. It doesn't rush through certain factors. I think it has a very clear idea of what it's trying to say and what scenes it needs to, get through to get there. So this movie is just a little over 2 hours.
Yeah.
And I think that, in today's modern age of like everything being 2.5 hours, and especially for biopics, this may seem like a bit of a commitment, but it really isn't. I think like you are setting in for like a really good, like forward moving experience. I never find this movie boring. I never find it like slow. I think that it is just consistently like dramatically interesting. And to end with that beautiful image and that like just tracking shot of seeing everything that he's surrounded by, I just think it's a wonderful, wonderful ending,
Yeah, I think the ending came full circle. I personally, I'm not bothered by, them cutting to his mother and then the sky, like the stars and everything. But if they had just had him lay down and softly go into permanent sleep.
Uh-huh.
I would have been fine with that if they just dipped to black after that. Because to me, it would have been like, you know, he was dying anyway and met fulfillment in a positive way in his life. And, you know, at least in the movie's case, took the liberty of saying, I'm done now.
Yeah.
I would have been fine if they were like, that's it. We're done.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. And they definitely meet the end of the arc and the message that they're going for. And if someone takes issue with them with that picture of, you know, love will never die, like, I'm not going to argue with that. Maybe that could be like the one kind of hokey thing in the movie, but I like it. Like,
yeah.
I think I like actually like kind of really like it because of, again, the clear the reference and like ending on one more like homage to those early cinema. And the mother is a character that does kind of follow the movie in a way just because of how much she's referenced. And it's a good bookend because it's the first person you start the movie with and then you end with it. And like having her say something, while not, I don't think necessary for the story, is, I think it's a good, I think it's a good choice. Like I like it. And, you know, Love Will Never Die, I think, is an interesting way to end it because, you know, I don't necessarily think, like, you know, the overall love is the main theme of this movie, but, you know, I think ending with the positivity that they were trying to lead with it, as opposed to making this, you know, very glim and being like, people are shitty, you know?
Yeah.
And if it, like, if he was laying down to die, to be like, way more people are, you know, way more people hate me and are afraid of me than those who love me. That, I think, would have been, that's the way more cynical ending of it. So maybe they wanted to just be absolutely clear to be like, we're not saying like this isn't ending badly. Like, this is like good, you know, thumbs up. I think the style choice, I like, you know, zooming through the stars and going like out into like a broader world.
Do you think maybe it's a callback? Because there was the scene with Treves and his wife and, you know, Merrick was talking about his mother and he said, I wonder if she saw me now, if she could truly love me.
I think so. I think, again, kind of getting into that, you know, that childlike aspect of like, you know, that like, you know, motherly attachment there. So maybe, I think that's an interesting way to read that, selling that final point of like, there will always be someone to love you. Maybe it is kind of, I don't know if it's necessarily confirmation that she would have been comfortable with him, but confirmation that someone does.
Right.
Yeah, I guess I didn't think about that at first, because yeah, that's what he does say in that scene, doesn't he?
Something.
Good one, good one.
Something to think about.
All right, so we end all these episodes the same way. We want to talk about, as a movie based on a true story, what can we learn about life from this movie? So as someone who watched it for the first time, please take it away.
I mean, maybe it's a little on the nose, but it's not exactly something you have to read too far into, is, you know, how about that golden rule? Treat others the way that you would want to be treated, because having a rough exterior in no way defines how someone is as a person. And I think that, you know, we're all in this society where beauty is the standard, right? If someone is appealing to look at, that automatically means that they're a good person, but that's not always the case. And it makes you think twice about, how am I treating people, you know, when I approach them? Am I treating them differently because of a certain condition or a certain way that they present themselves, you know, and really thinking at the heart of it, that we are all just people and we need to treat each other like that. And I think, you know, that kind of comes back to a lot of social movements that we've seen recently, Black Lives Matter and, you know, LGBTQ community attempting to, you know, keep rights when that's being threatened. Thinking about, you know, just because people are a certain way doesn't mean that we need to look at them differently. I think that's definitely the big thing in this movie.
Very well said. For me, it comes down to my two favorite quotes in the movie. Also a bit on the nose, but so beautifully written. The first one is in that scene that we mentioned, when he's having tea with those two people in his room. And he says, people are frightened by what they don't understand, which is a good encapsulation, again, of a theme, especially what we're seeing with, you know, transgender rights right now and people trying, or some people trying and others refusing to allow trans people to be able to conform to society as everyone else, that it's impossible for people to wrap their heads around a concept like that. And so they're terrified of it. And it's fear mongering. And it's, I don't mean to get like, you know, super political, but like, you know, because it's so pertinent in society today, I think that that is something, again, because this movie deals with such big modern themes, or like that you can put in any society or any time, you know, it's just in this movie, it's about a man with physical deformity. Today, it can be about people who are having issues with gender identity and struggling through that and trying to be like a normal and be seen as a normal person. And, you know, I think that that is a true problem that we constantly run into of people being completely frightened by what they can't wrap their head around and not being able to put the work in to change. That is very true. And I think a bit more of the, maybe cynical is the wrong word, but because I think that that is so true, you know, it is a bit more the negative one. But the other one is the positive one, which is my favorite line in the movie after like he's getting ready to go to the theater. He says, "My life is full because I know that I am loved." And I think that's such a beautiful sentiment and something that I've tried to lead with in my life of like, you know, I mean, and I don't want to mean that as like comparing myself to the life that John Merrick led, because that's not what I'm saying, but like pushing through personal adversity and going through such, you know, troubles in your life, what really matters is that he found people that loved him and he knew it and he felt that in his heart. Like that's, I mean, the one scene that we didn't mention too much is when he goes to Frederick Treves' home and, you know, begins crying because he, you know, is offered tea and is like so like surrounded by kindness. And, you know, he really feels that. And he's like, this is what I've always wanted. I've always wanted someone to treat me like you're saying, people are treating me the way I want to be treated. And he treats them the same way with such enthusiasm and love and just comfort. And, you know, when he gets like the beauty case or something, like the dress case or whatever, he's just like, he doesn't even know how to like react. He's just like, oh, thank you. Thank you. And he's just like going through it because he doesn't really know. And he's like, he's almost like playing dress up with it, like putting like the cologne on. And it's so lovely. And to just know in his heart that people love him for who he is, he thinks he has fulfilled his, you know, he's fulfilled his duty in life. And that is, you know, I think a really wonderful sentiment, that to put it in those words, you know, in this movie was so wonderful to hear.
I mean, you know, at the end of the day, like, yes, people need basic things like food, water and sleep to survive, but you also need genuine human connection. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really hard to get through the day to day if you don't have people that, you know, care for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I love this movie. I love it so much. We'll definitely be talking about David Lynch again at some point on this show. I'll have to show you either Blue Velvet or Mulholland Drive just to see your reaction for me, because like I've seen those movies so many times that like I know them so well. But to me, it's the reaction of others that like I've shown it to my friend Will, and he was just like, "What the fuck?" Like, you know, it's such a great thing to see in there. And those movies aren't for everybody, for sure. But it's just you never know until you dive in. Yeah. So we'll have to do that at some point. So that does it for this episode of Frankly, I Love Movies. In the real world, you can follow the show on social media, Frankly, I Love Movies on Instagram and Facebook. Please be sure to like, comment, subscribe, leave a 5-star rating on your favorite podcasting platform of choice, and definitely check out our social media, because you can find out what our next episode is via some clues that we're gonna put in there. It's gonna be very exciting. Also, big thanks to Rihanna Henson for doing this season's artwork, and to Kanan Harris for doing the music of our show. And of course, thank you, Lexi, for doing this series with me.
I love it.
All right. Until next time, I'm Josh Wall.
And I'm Lexi Cutmore.
Frankly, I Love Movies.
And frankly, I Love True Stories.